right, y'all. Hello, welcome to Midweek in the City. How are we doing? So we've had a crazy schedule because we were off for Holy Week and Easter was so early. We were off for spring break right before that. So we've gotten out of our normal rhythm, but now we're back. We're good, okay? And so I know. So we'll go through, we have Wednesday nights here through through May 1st, and then we'll take our summer break. But we still have several more in the spring semester, and so I'm really excited. I'm excited that y'all are here, and we'll have a few more coming over from orchestra, but I'm glad y'all are here. I'm glad y'all got back into the swing of things with us. You know, it's hard once you get out of your normal routine to get back into it. So I'm glad y'all are here. I have a few announcements. Now, I had like a million announcements every week leading up to Easter. Thankfully, there's just a few things that I want to make sure y'all are aware of, because we do have a few new folks with us tonight, or folks that have never been to Midweek before. And so, or if you're new to our church, I just want to make you aware of a couple things. First of all, the next couple weeks at Midweek, I'm excited. Now, y'all remember in the days of Brian, Father Brian, we did Ask Brian Whatever. Now, we technically did one, an Ask Megan Whatever, back in the pandemic days, but that was like five of us on Zoom. You know, that was a long time ago. So I'm excited for Ask Megan Whatever. So if you, I've gotten bold enough. It took me 4 years, but I've gotten bold enough to try this again. So submit your questions. Text me, email me, carrier pigeon your questions to me, and I'm excited for next week. It's going to be a fun week. And then after that, this is something that came out of our little time of strategic planning in this room way back in January. That feels like forever ago. But one of the suggestions was, what if we talked through where our church has been and where our church is going? And so if y'all don't know Susan Spoon, she is a church member, and she is basically the unofficial church historian. Okay, she has written all of those books on this church. She has compiled all of that information, and she is just fantastic and so brilliant. And so she is coming to talk through where our church has been. Right, we've talked a lot about Baptists aren't great at knowing church history. Right, that is not one of our strong suits. But Susan Spoon is at least great at knowing this church's history, which is something, and it's a good place to start. Right, and so she's going to come and join us, and then Pastor Chris will be with her. So Susan is giving us where we've been, and Chris is going to give us where are we headed. Where does he see this church going? Where does he see change happening and those kind of things? And so I'm excited for those 2 weeks coming up. It's going to be good discussions. And then April 14th. So if you are new to this church, or you've been discerning whether you want to become a member or those kind of things, or if you just want to learn more about, you know, even if you've been attending for a while, but you want to learn more about the church, on April 14th, beginning at 8:30, going through lunchtime that Sunday, we have our next Discover class. And so you get a tour of the church, which you found your way here, which is impressive. So you've at least gotten that down. But our church is kind of a labyrinth. So you'll get a tour of the church. You'll get to meet with Pastor Chris and Pastor Danny and sit down and just talk through what our church does, what we believe, those kind of things. So if you're interested in that, or if you just want some more information about the church, sign up for Discover class on the 14th. Also on the 14th, I was just talking over dinner with our guest about, we have several congregations here at the church, and most of y'all know this. We have a Congolese congregation, we have several Burmese congregations, a Spanish congregation, and Tara Koba, she has come to Midweek before. She's a friend of ours. She leads those international congregations, and specifically those congregations that are primarily made up of Burmese folks. They are struggling because of the events happening in Burma. If y'all don't know, Burma has been through terrible tragedy over these last couple years under a military coup, and lots has been happening over there. She still has her parents and family over there, and a lot of the folks here at First Baptist that belong to those congregations are refugees that came because of the violence happening in Burma. And so on April 14th at 5 o'clock, we are going to have over in 4th Street Crossing just a time of prayer and a time of intercession and a time of just praying for the people of Burma and for the Burmese congregations here. They're carrying some heavy things. And so I just want y'all to know that that is coming. And I think those are all of our... Now, normally, we have discussion questions around tables, but we have a lot to talk through tonight, and I want to make sure we have enough time to get through everything that we want to get through. So we'll have plenty of time for Q&A at the end, so we're going to save our discussion for the end. But without further ado, we have Dr. Daryl Bach joining us tonight, and so come on up and join us. We are so excited to have you here. He flew in from Dallas. He came at the perfect time to be in San Antonio. that 1 month that we have perfect weather. And so thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. And so Dr. Bach is a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. And he, if you've read through things on Christianity Today before, you've probably seen one of his articles. But you do all kinds of stuff. And we're going to unpack those things here. So just to start us off, tell us about the work that you do over there at DTS and how you became interested in this work. How did you get started with all of this?
So I am in my 42nd year of teaching New Testament studies at Dallas. I'm senior research professor there and have helped design a master's apologetics program that we have been unveiling over the last 4 years. And about 14 years ago, I became executive director for cultural engagement at the Hendricks Center, which is an attempt to talk about it. The Hendricks Center is the Hendricks Center for Christian Leadership and Cultural Engagement. And when it was founded in 1986 and our culture was in one place, the goal of the center was to talk about leadership and character and those kinds of issues. The way organizations work, how to run an efficient and good organization, how to do that Christianly, those kinds of questions. Yeah. And the culture, in the meantime, had shifted so much that it became clear that it's hard to run an organization without knowing what's going on around it.
Yeah.
And so I had been involved in public square discussions really since the 1990s. And had done consulting work for some of the networks on certain shows that they put on in relationship to religion, had worked with Christianity Today in background a lot of times. And so it was a natural space for me that I had evolved into, and I actually see it as the natural landing place for someone who's spent as much time as I had working in the Gospels in particular and Acts. And so... So the school developed a podcast at my initiative in the middle of the aughts of this decade, and then we formalized it in 2010 and decided we're going to do this more regularly, not just ad hoc as things come up, and that led into my coming into the center to be executive director and to help with cultural engagement. Howard Hendricks' son, Bill Hendricks, runs the Christian leadership side of the center, and we together run the center along with our assistant director, who's Kim Cook, who's been with us now a little over 10 years.
Awesome.
And she has helped organize us because Bill and I are neat organization. And so that's what we've been doing. So it's an attempt to express theology. I came in and formalized a weekly podcast called The Table Podcast, which we do. Welcome to The Table. We discuss issues of God and culture and the relevance of theology to everyday life. And
so is this The Table Podcast featuring the Midweek in the City podcast? I guess this
I guess if you want to do that. Yeah, well, it's a wedding made in heaven.
Yeah.
And so... So we've been doing that. That was one of the things I instituted as soon as I came in. And we discuss anything and everything. It literally is. We do systematic theological discussions. We take a look at the impact of evangelicalism and Christian faith in different countries. Yeah. We've discussed the history of creeds. We do apologetics. We've done over 70 podcasts that touch on LGBTQ issues.
Wow.
We're coming up this month. We will have done 600 episodes in that time. They run about 45 minutes each, all interview-based, and like I say, it just covers the gamut of stuff. Arts is another thing we do. Christians in the workplace is another thing that we zero in on.
Yeah.
So we're trying to deal with, many people have a secular, sacred divide in their life. Mm-hmm. We're trying to deal with that and challenge that way of thinking about the world.
Yeah. Do y'all see why I wanted him to come to Midweek in the City? This is like exactly what we love, like what we want to talk about here. So that's, and you in 2020 wrote Cultural Intelligence, and obviously that is the project that I'm assuming came out of all of this work at the initiative and the center, but cultural intelligence, living for God in a diverse and pluralistic world. And I would really encourage y'all to pick up a copy of this. I read through it and was like, this is part of the conversation that we've been missing here. You know, we were talking about this over dinner. We've tried, right, from multiple different angles. And I think we've gotten closer and closer to the center every time. But to talk through how do we engage in difficult stuff in our culture well as Christians, where we're curious and open-minded, but still holding to our conviction of Scripture and of truth. And this gets us so much closer to the center of that. This is a really valuable text. And so what led you to write this specifically?
Well, I was frustrated with the way in which Christians were slow to recognize the nature of the time that we're in. They complained about it. They knew what kind of time they were in. They felt the pressure of it. But we actually don't have a theology of cultural engagement in the church.
Yeah.
And the reason we probably didn't have it is because, at least in this part of the world, our culture was pretty monoculturally oriented to Christianity, and so there didn't feel to be the need for it. We could do our evangelism and everything else in the context of a Judeo-Christian net and bubble that surrounded our culture, and so we didn't need it. But now we are operating in a clearly pluralistic environment in which there are many worldviews around us. I normally, when I talk about this, I start off with the Telstar satellite and say, the Telstar satellite changed the way we see the world. I actually see it as the catalyst for the impact of technology on our world. Launched in 1962, it allowed a signal to go live from North America to Europe and then back to North America from Europe. And in the first broadcast that was done in the summer of 1962, it's interesting, only black and white, okay? Signal went one way, only could go one direction. You had to turn it off and reboot it in order to get the signal to go the other direction. I guess they had to flip a switch that changed the direction of the arrow. 3 hours later, after the reboot, they were ready to rebroadcast.
Wow.
So now you think about that versus what we are able to do with this.
Yeah.
Okay? That's a mega revolution.
Yeah.
And what it means is we're more tightly connected than we've ever been. There are more of us on the world than ever been. We're also more aware of one another than we've ever been, or at least have the potential to be more aware of one another than we've ever been. There are more of us, but we're more tightly connected. And I like to tell people the world has become like a bazaar, a Middle Eastern bazaar. I don't know if you've ever been to the Middle East and been in a Middle Eastern bazaar, but I like to tease people that whenever I think about this image, I think about the bazaar that I walked through in Istanbul, in which one of the barkers for one of the shops said, "The fastest way to my mother-in-law, to your mother-in-law's heart, is in my shop," which assumed that I cared about my mother-in-law. And so anyway, but our world is like a bazaar. There are a million booths out there in terms of how people live, the choices they have, et cetera. And some of those booths at the bazaar are pretty bizarre. And the ability of Christians to adjust to the nature of difference that has been injected into our understanding of the world is a challenge for the church, particularly when the church believes, and rightly so, that it has a message for that world. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that well? And we don't have a theology of cultural engagement, so one of the goals in the book was to write a little bit of a skeleton of what a theology of cultural engagement might look like, how to think about it, and then there was a premise underneath it, because you asked, why did I do this?
Yeah.
And I said I was frustrated with the church. So now it's time to confess the frustration. And it was that it was my deep belief that the way in which we had fought the culture war, which had been the dominant way to engage the culture since I was a seminary student back in the 1970s, was biblically flawed. Not just flawed, but biblically flawed, and flawed in such major ways that it not only was doing damage to our society, it was doing damage to the church. Not because of the convictions that the church wanted to have, but because the way those convictions were delivered and communicated.
Yeah.
And so the book is about showing where those flaws are, talking about another way to do it while having those convictions, and then thinking about what that actually takes to deliver applicationally in a relational manner as you think about interacting with people on the outside. One of my complaints is this, that we have made people the enemy, and the Great Commission tells us that people are outside the church are our goal.
Yeah.
They're part of the mission that we undertake. So when we make people the enemy, we've created the wrong enemy. And I go to Ephesians 6, 10 to 18, where we talk about that is the spiritual battle, you know, cultural war passage of the Bible. And I make a point that that battle is spiritual. It's not against people. In fact, Ephesians 6, 12 says our battle is not against flesh and blood, which is kind of emphatic.
Yeah.
Okay? But it's against spiritual forces in the heavenly places. The Greek word for spiritual forces in that passage is the word cosmocrat. So I tease people, you think a bureaucrat is bad, you should meet a cosmocrat. So the whole point here is this is a spiritual battle. It requires spiritual resources. And the armor that defends us in that passage is our lived-out faith.
Yeah.
Our lived-out faith demonstrating constructively the heart of God for people.
Yeah.
It's rooted in truth. It's rooted in righteousness. It's rooted in the Word of God. It's rooted in salvation. It's rooted in prayer. All those kinds of things. That doesn't mean you don't engage, but how you engage becomes very, very important. And I tell people the image that we have in the culture war is there's a Christian battalion that needs to defeat the non-Christian battalion, and you just overrun them. That's not the image. The image is that there are people trapped in this spiritual blindness that comes from these spiritual forces. And you're more like special forces. In fact, I tease people, you want to sign on to the GIA, God's Intelligence Agency, and be a special forces person who goes to rescue someone who's in the grips of someone and in danger because of it. Only the trick is, and this is what makes it hard, is those spiritual forces work incognito. Some people don't even see them, and many people don't even believe they exist. So it's one thing to rescue someone when they know they're in trouble and need to be rescued. It's another thing to try and rescue someone who doesn't have a clue they're even got a problem. Yeah. So that's the challenge of the public space. And the other thing that's important about the Ephesians passage is that we are told to stand the ground that we are on as a result of salvation. We are not told to take new ground. We invite people into the church. We don't try and make the world into the church. We try and bring people into a relationship with God. And the church is an institution that exists in the midst of the world, not to change the world, but to be the church. And that's the way people are drawn, these people who are trapped or caught are drawn. And that draw is that an effectively, consistently lived out Christian life and Christian community, which we often lack today. And in fact, the way we fight the world is the way the world fights us, which turns us into a special interest group. And if we're just a special interest group like the other special interest groups, people have a lot of special interest groups to choose from, and they will.
So that's
the short version of that.
Yeah. No, and that's... So you've talked about, you know, we're more connected to one another than we've ever been. But it also, I don't know if it's me and just my perception, but it, like you said, we are more hostile to one another than we've ever been, right? Do you think, what do you think has caused that increase in hostility or the perception of that increase in hostility?
I think people are overwhelmed by the difference.
Yeah.
It's figuring out how to balance my relationship to my neighbor who is different than I am. Mm-hmm. I tell people that when you think about public space, we've got a room full of tables here. It's, you know, nice. When you think about the table that's in the public space, it works this way. And I don't mean to shock you, but just hang with me. At the table of public space, your religion means nothing. And here's what I mean when I say that. What I mean is, every person who's a citizen in the United States of America has the same rights regardless of their religious beliefs. Even if they don't have religious beliefs, they have the same rights. So that means when you're at the public space table, you have, in their eyes, no sense of privilege. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, how do I work in that environment with the differences that we see? And how do I think about being persuasive for the things that I care about when that is the way everyone sees that public space? Mm-hmm. Even Christians recognize, yes, everyone who's a citizen in the United States has the same rights. Mm-hmm. And, yes, there's religious freedom, but that means I can believe what I want. Mm-hmm. That also means I cannot believe if I want.
Yeah.
So how do I work in that kind of space? That becomes the challenge of cultural engagement. And people are overwhelmed by the difference. They want to reaffirm in their sense of identity that they are right and they are wrong, which tends to produce an us and them mentality. And we go from there.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, this term of culture wars has always grated on me a little bit. It just feels overly simplistic, right? Or like we've missed the point somehow. If, you know, is the goal that we move the sticks ever so slightly towards what we believe in the cultural, you know, Christian majority is the right move, and then that's a win, right? Is framing it as a culture war, you know, flawed from the get-go?
Well, the danger is that by turning it into a culture war and trying to make the world into the church, which it isn't, and I will add, never will be until God comes back. We've actually gotten off mission because the place where people are changed and spiritually equipped to live in a way that honors God requires that they be brought towards the church. But if we make the world the goal and put our effort towards the world in being the goal, we risk relativizing and, in fact, minimizing the role of the church in the world. And the church gets off target for what it's supposed to be in the midst of the world. So there are numerous implications for being aimed, if you will, in the wrong direction here.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we, because we read verses like, right, on earth as it is in heaven, right? Or these, you know, we're bringing the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God to earth, right? And so it is logical, right, that then we would say, well, then government should reflect our interpretation of that, or right, but you're saying that's not necessarily, yes, we're bringing the kingdom of God to earth, but that looks different than maybe we.
Well, the place where the kingdom of God is really active and where God is supposed to commits himself to really working, is in his people.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that you don't try and persuade in the public square,
right?
But then that requires a level of awareness. This is the cultural intelligence part. That requires a level of awareness about where the person who is listening to me is coming from as I seek to engage them.
Yeah.
And so think about this for a second. This is, I'm going to do nothing but bother you. If you don't have sleep well tonight, I'm sorry. but you say God says or the Bible says. I'll say that in public. If someone doesn't believe in God, what have you said to them? Nothing. Okay, that's not a warrant to them. That doesn't deal with what it is that you're presenting them. That's part of the blindness that we're talking about, okay, that exists. That has to be dealt with. Which means oftentimes when you're engaging in evangelism and sharing Christ, you're sharing Christ with someone for whom you also need to create categories that they may not have currently. There are, when you share the gospel, there are four fundamental questions that are assumed in the offer of the gospel that need to be in place in order for the gospel to communicate. Let me tell you what those are. Does God exist? Does he speak in the Bible? Here's one. How many human beings has there ever been who've walked the earth, out of all the billions of people who've ever walked the earth, who are simultaneously God and human? How many? It's not a big category. It's one Jesus is a unicorn, okay? He is a one of a kind and totally unique. If a person has no category, and they can have this category in a couple of ways, but it's not the biblical category. If they have a category, well, all of us are divine in one sense or another, okay? That's not what you're talking about, okay? And if they don't believe in divinity, then how do you even have that conversation? You see what you're up against.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the third question. The fourth question is this. You are accountable to the Creator God whether you recognize it or not. That's wrapped up in the offer of the gospel. So those four questions, those four categories need to be in place in order, in some sense, in order for someone to actually appreciate what's being said in the gospel.
Yeah.
So how do I engage with someone to take them to places and categories they currently don't have?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what's behind that. Listen to the testimony of people who come to the Lord who did not grow up in a Christian home. Okay, just think about them as an aggregate, as a category.
Yeah.
Okay, I came to the Lord in college. I did not grow up in a Christian home. If you will listen to those testimonies, they almost always take, at some point, this tact in the presentation. I met this person. I met so-and-so. I don't mean that they're a so-and-so, but I met so-and-so. And they were a Christian. And I noticed that their life was different. And I became curious.
Yeah.
That's the lived out Christian life of Ephesians 6 and the armor demonstrating itself. And in the midst of that relational connection, the opportunity comes to create those categories that we're talking about that people don't currently have.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is not just a discussion of truth in the abstract or truth merely being contended for. We're talking about the relational dimension of reaching out to people as you engage that actually has the opportunity to create those categories that people need in order to appreciate what the gospel is because they don't have them by default.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we've, I think in this framework of culture wars, right, we lose, like you said, we lose track of what our goal is, right, what our mission is because it's that we've somehow won a battle and we've defeated you, but that was never the goal, right? The goal was to bring you into the arms of Jesus.
People are not the enemy. They're actually the goal.
Yeah.
And the goal is to bring them into a relationship with God. And so I need to engage Public Square in a way that does that. Let me add layers to this because this all has layers. Another layer of this is this idea. We have seen the experiment of God being present in the midst of his people with a set of laws that he gives that they're to live by. You know where that story exists? In the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Okay? God had a people. He gave them his law. They were supposed to live by it. In fact, they said, we're going to live by this. And what's the history of Israel like in the Old Testament? It's a mess. Okay, yeah, someone did this, up and down, yep. That's what it's like a whale in the water, you know, up and down and up and down. Okay. It's a pretty uneven story. And at the end of the Old Testament, we get the offer of the new covenant that's designed to fix the problem, which is the change of heart inside a person. That spiritual dimension of what we're talking about that needs to be displayed in order to be appreciated and understood. So that's what we're talking about. I know that I'm in a Baptist church, okay? So I'm going to have fun now. I know Baptists, they know one verse backwards and forwards. It's John 3:16, right? Right? John, you preach that. You preach about being born again. That's A-G-I-N.
Yeah.
And you preach that from the pulpit, okay? All right? So we're gonna preach about being born again from the pulpit.
Yeah.
And everyone knows John 3:6, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever should believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only sentence I use the word whosoever in all the talking that I do. I like to simplify it to this. God so loved the world that he gave.
Mm-hmm.
And just think about what that's communicating. Here are people whose backs were turned to God. And oh, by the way, our backs were also turned to God at one point. Mm-hmm. And the way in which God dealt with the person whose back was turned to him was to give. Yeah. To give through his son. So, ask yourself this question. How often is that the message that is coming through the church to the world? Just think about that for a second. And so, what we're talking about here is a way of engagement that draws people not to the critique of humanity, although that's a part of the gospel that has to be dealt with alone, but also to the invitation that's on the other end of that. Mm-hmm. And let me make another point, which is this. If I only critique the presence of sin in people's life, even if I talk about the cross and the offer of forgiveness of sins, and I don't talk about the new life and the enablement that comes with it, that also is a part of the gospel, I have not shared the good news. Yeah. I've shared the setup for the good news. So we need to be sure that when we engage in a positive, constructive way that shows, by the way we treat and interact with people, that there is an invitation in the gospel into a different kind of life that we're supposed to be encouraging people to engage in. And if we don't have that dimension, and now I'm going to have some more fun, because I can get away with so much stuff in the Baptist church, okay? Let's illustrate it through baptism. If I only talk about the cross and I don't talk about the new life, or if I only talk about the new life in a certain way, it's a little, and we're going to be Baptist here, okay? We're not going to be Presbyterian. We're not going to sprinkle or just pour, okay? This is the whole shooting match, okay? Get that weak stuff out of here. Here we go. So I'm going to baptize, all right? And I'm only going to talk about the cross and what happens with death. So I go into the water, right?
Yeah.
And I'm dead to sin. That's the first part of the baptism, right? I'm dead to sin.
Yeah.
The other half of it is, it's actually Romans 6. We're raised what? To new life.
Yeah.
We're raised to new life. And that new life is the good news.
Yeah.
If I never get to the new life, if I never display the new life, if I never show the contrast that is the new life, then I have not engaged in a biblically rooted kind of cultural engagement.
Yeah.
That's the point that I'm making.
Yeah.
And that is done in a certain way and with a certain tone and with a certain approach. And the way we're doing it just lacks those elements of hope and tone that are so important with the engagement we should be engaged in, even in the midst of the challenge. I'm not saying don't talk about sin or don't talk about the cross. I'm not saying that. But you've got to get to the other side of what that's for.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what we've, you know, we're doing a series on Proverbs on Sunday mornings at First Baptist. And we just read a week or two ago, you know, when you walk in wisdom, you will walk in kindness and truth, right? And it was interesting that those were the words that came out of that, right? Because that's what it feels like. There's this tightrope that we're being asked to walk, right? And only by the power of the Spirit can we do that well, right? But this, it is hard for us as Christians to be committed to kindness, right? And to offering that hope, but also being committed to truth, right? And that's where we normally kind of stumble into one side of that, and we don't hold those very well.
Oh, we love the truth.
Yeah, right.
We love the truth.
Right. Or the opposite, right?
It's so all love kindness, and, that's right, that we never yeah. talk about what people need.
Right.
A passage, you know, I think y'all believe in the Bible, right, here?
Yes.
All right. So, and did you bring you have access to a Bible?
Yeah.
Okay, so now I get to have fun. Okay, how many of you brought a Bible that has a thing called pages in it? Anyway, do you have it with you? No, pages. No, that doesn't count. You got one.
Ooh.
You got one. We got one person hanging in there. All right. Okay. Then most of us, like me, your Bible is on your. Is it on a device? Right, like this. And I tell people, if you have a Bible on your phone. You don't have a smartphone. You have a spiritual phone. Okay? Give it credit for having the Bible.
Apple has no idea.
All right? Yeah. So if you have a Bible with you, and I don't care whether it's pages and you turn there or it's your device and you swipe there, okay? Turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13. And this is a famous passage almost in every memory verse program that I'm aware of because of verse 15. But set Christ apart as Lord in your hearts. Always be ready to give a defense for the hope that is in you. Yeah. You know that passage. All right? The term defense is the Greek word apologia. It's where we get the term apologetics from, giving a defense of your faith. Doesn't mean you're sorry for your faith. It means I'm giving a defense for my faith. Mm-hmm. But I want to look at this passage in context because I think it has a lot to teach us about cultural engagement. So here it is. Verse 13. Now, who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? Probably one of the easiest verses in the Bible, okay? Do the right thing.
Yeah.
Do the right thing. Do the right thing because it's what you ought to do, okay? Mm-hmm. And who's going to harm you if you do this, if you're zealous for what's good? It's a rhetorical question that opens a section. Everything else in the rest of the passage is going to push against it. But it's what I tell my kids and what I tell my grandkids. Do the right thing. Don't do things that will invite harm to come to you.
Yeah.
But we live in a fallen world. So verse 14 follows. But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, don't run by that phrase.
Yeah.
You're going to suffer for righteousness' sake. Okay? That phrase shouldn't make sense, but it does.
Yeah.
Okay, I call this box law. Every good deed will get punished. Okay? It's what Jesus taught the disciples. If you follow down my way, the world is going to push back. Don't be surprised.
Yeah.
Okay? So, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. That wasn't exactly what I expected by default on the other end of that, but we'll take it. It's what the Bible says. And then here's the next line, and this is a line I think the church needs to process. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. If you suffer for righteousness' sake, if box law applies to your life, every good deed will get punished, the one response I'm not supposed to have is to respond out of fear or be troubled by what's going on around me because Jesus told you so. Then we get our verse. But in your hearts, honor Christ or set Christ apart as Lord, or as Lord, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Let me just stop there. I think it is fascinating that when Peter has one word to summarize what our faith is all about, he chooses the word hope.
Mm-hmm.
He could have chosen grace. He could have chosen forgiveness. He could have chosen love. He could have chosen all kinds of things. But the word that he chooses is the word hope. That's the invitation part of what I'm talking about. And so we're supposed to be looking towards this hope and sharing this hope. When the church speaks to the world, it's supposed to speak to the world with hope, mm-hmm. ultimately. And then it goes on to say this. Yet do it when you set Christ apart as Lord in your hearts and talk about this hope. Do it with gentleness and respect. See the tone that's tied to it? And I ask myself two questions so far that this verse raises. The first is the church responding out of fear and because it's troubled? And the second is, when I communicate with the world, do I do so with gentleness and respect? Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying the way in which we've conducted the culture war in terms of its tone doesn't match what the Bible says about the way we should engage.
Yeah.
Having a good conscience so when you are slandered, there's box law a second time. Okay? You're going to get slandered. Just expect it. Okay? Those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good. There it is a third time. Okay? You're going to suffer for doing good. Box law will apply. Just sign up.
Yeah.
If that should be God's will, then for doing evil. And then we get the explanation for why we respond this way. And this is the part of the passage that I think is so important because it gives a mindset. Here it is. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous. And you go, yep, mm-hmm. Christ died for the ungodly. Christ died for them.
Yeah.
And the next line's a curveball. Because the next line says that he might bring us to God. It ain't about them, it's about us. We are the recipients of God's grace. When our back was turned to God, God tapped us on the shoulder and got our attention by his grace. When someone's back is turned to God, you now have the opportunity to replicate how God treated you when he brought you to himself.
Yeah.
That mindset is completely different. It's completely different than generally the way we approach people who are rebelling against God.
Yeah.
And so this passage has much to teach us about the tone of our engagement.
Yeah.
And I could take you to other passages like Colossians 4, 5, and 6 that talk about let your speech always be gracious. Okay? Always, 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 always. Emphatic, technical term. How frequent is always?
Always.
All the time. Exactly right. Okay? Right? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week,
yeah.
52 weeks out of the year, 365 days most years, 366 in a leap year. You don't get to take a day off every 4 years. Okay? All right? Always. All the time. Or Galatians 6:10. That was about our speech. Galatians 6:10 is about our acts. Do good to all people, especially those of the faith. That passage is important because it says this. I'm supposed to treat all people the same way, whether they're in the faith or not.
Mm-hmm.
Do good to all people, especially. It should certainly be happening among the people of God, but it's supposed to be happening everywhere.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is the distinctive Christian ethic? What makes Christian ethic of love distinctive? Answer that question. Who do we love?
Christ.
Who do we even love? Our enemies.
Oh, yeah.
Our enemies. That's what. If you love those who love you, you are no better than the way the sinner loves. That's what Jesus said.
Yeah.
So, when you put this all together, there is an approach that you engage with that is very, very important and also very challenging.
Yeah.
Because it's not instinctive. It requires the Spirit of God to do and to do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what I think some of us, we might wrestle with being able to do that, partially because we don't have a great understanding of the grace that we've been given.
Exactly right.
We're still digesting that in some way. And it is hard to give that grace that we are still processing. Right?
I tell people a key to what we're talking about is to never forget where you came from and how mm-hmm. you got to where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that attitude of grateful for the grace of God, for the undeserving position that you were in, put you in a position to have the right kind of empathy for the person whose back is currently turned to God.
Yeah.
Because you ought to see a reflection of yourself before you came to God
yeah.
in that person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, so we're talking about how do we engage better, right, in the public square. And when we say the public square, that feels like now we're all Plato and we're like orating, right? We sort of have a public square, but not really, right? The public square is in the workplace, right, with your coworkers. It's here to some extent, right, when we have folks come and visit. It's
whenever you're not in church.
Yeah, right. It's whenever you're out in the world, mm-hmm. right? And so, especially now, this is impeccable timing for this conversation, and I didn't plan it this way, but we're in an election year, right? There is ripe opportunity to practice some of this stuff. But as we enter into this year that's giving us these opportunities, that's how we're going to reframe it in a positive way. We have all these opportunities during this election year to practice this. What are some things that we can keep in mind as we're entering into those spaces? You said, you know, the tone that we carry. What are some things that we can keep in mind to do those things better while we're in those
conversations? So we're talking about having difficult conversations.
Yeah.
Difficult conversations are conversations that you have when you know the person sitting across from the table doesn't think the same way you do. That's what a difficult conversation is. So how are you going to do that and do that well? Well, first of all, you better understand how conversations work. Okay? All right? Because there's the conversation that you're having, and then there's the real conversation that's actually going on.
Yeah.
And the next thing that I'm going to say to you is not only going to help you in the public square, it's going to help you in all your relationships. So you're getting a twofer now. Okay? So here it goes. And I have a word for the day. This is like Sesame Street. How many of you were raised on Sesame Street? Okay,
yeah.
I have to connect you to your roots. All right? The word for the day is triphonics. Now, how often do you use that word in a sentence? Okay?
I remember that episode.
Triphonics, okay? The idea of triphonics is there are three channels operating simultaneously. Stereo, two speakers. Quadraphonic sound, four speakers. Triphonic, three radio signals going through any conversation at any given time. They're operating simultaneously. They're bouncing off one another as the conversation happens. And here's how it works. The first channel is the topic you're talking about, whatever it is. Okay, so there's the topic that you're discussing, whatever it is, and I'm here to tell you that's the frosting on this cake. Okay, that's not where the real conversation is happening. Yeah. The real conversation is happening in two other levels, on two other channels, that are broadcasting simultaneously along with the topic, whatever it is that you're talking about. The middle channel are the lenses you use to see what's in front of you, okay, in life. All right? Lenses.
Yeah.
How can I explain this? I'll just do it in one phrase. CNN and Fox.
Yeah.
Okay? Those are lenses.
Yeah.
All right? They are the same thing is out there for all of us, right? Okay? We're all looking at the same thing. We may not be seeing the same thing, but we're all looking at the same thing.
Yeah.
What determines what I focus on and what I don't focus on are the lenses I use to look in what's in front of me. And what's interesting about the illustration is when you listen to CNN and Fox talk about anything in the public square, sometimes you wonder, are these people living on the same planet? That's what lenses do. They impact how and what I see, okay? And everything that I'm describing applies to everybody, okay? Just in different ways. Applies to everybody. So the second thing beyond the topic are the lenses that you use. And then underneath that, a third channel is broadcasting that in some ways may be even more important than the first two. And that is the way my identity and interests are wrapped up in what I'm talking about. What I see to be at stake in the conversation that is driving me to react in the way that I do. And so there are three levels. So let me illustrate this for you, okay? So I'm going to illustration. I like having fun, so I'm going to have fun. I was born with a gift. It was the gift of multitasking, and it drove my mother crazy, okay? Now, psychologists will tell you no one truly ever multitasks, but I had the gift, okay? So, you know, I tried to get away with it. So when I was young, I'm a big sports fan, I used to listen to multiple sporting events at the same time, which was pretty noisy, which drove my mother crazy.
Blaze does this, and I don't know how he does it.
Okay, all right, yeah, this is a gift.
So, I just feel overwhelmed.
This illustration is going to be a guy-gal thing, so just hang with me, all right? So I had this gift, and my mother would come in, And she would say, turn that down. Listen to only one of them. But I said, but I know what's going on. How do you know what's going on? And I would tell her, okay, this really made her feel good, right? I could tell her what was going on in each game and where it stood, okay, which I learned later was a bad habit. But nonetheless, all right, that's how I dealt with it. So years later, my wife, she was my wife-to-be at the time, married the gift. She married me, okay? All right? She got married to the gift, all right? And so I'll tell you how the gift manifests itself today. The way the gift manifests itself today is in front of a computer screen. So I'm sitting in front of a computer screen, you know, doing what I'm doing, trying to accomplish what I'm setting out to do for the day, and my wife walks in with breaking news, something that she wants me to hear, that she wants me to process with her, right? And she tells me what's on her heart, all right? And I can multitask. I have the gift, all right? So my gaze is still on that computer screen, okay? But my ears are perked up, okay? Because I have the gift, so my ears go boop, okay? And I take in what she says. And then she says this to me. You're not listening to me. I go, you forgot you married the gift, okay? All right? Now, that's the hour of decision, because now there are two things that I can do. One, and I'm capable of doing this because I have the gift, I can report back to her word for word what she said to me. In proof that I actually did hear the words and they made a stop in my brain as she was uttering them to me. Now, it may have been in an outburger, all right? But at least it stopped in my brain, and I could do that. And I can tell you, having done this in the past, not a very effective response, okay? It doesn't work, okay? It just doesn't work, okay? Or I can give her my attention. Because you see, what's really going on is what I heard and what she was saying, and they're not the same thing. What I heard was, you're not a good husband. Okay? That's how my identity is now wrapped up in this conversation. And what she was saying to me is, I'm not important enough to you for you to give me your undivided attention. You're saying I don't deserve your undivided attention. And you know what? She's right. But do you see what's happening? The conversation is not about listening. Yeah. The conversation is about what's going on at the identity level between us. Yeah. Okay? Most conflict relationally, whether you're married or not, operates at those two levels simultaneously. And people think they're fighting about the topic. That's just the frosting. Okay? Yeah. They're really fighting about something else that's going on between them. And if they don't recognize that, they've got a problem. So here's my point. When we engage in conversations, if we really want to be engaged in a conversation, I need to be sensitive to and aware of where the other person is coming from. I'm not necessarily saying my initial response is to determine whether they're right or wrong, which is our default. Yeah. Okay? Our default in a conversation is to say, I'm going to assess what you're telling me, without engaging you in the conversation about it, okay? And I say, we all have a doctrinal meter if we've grown up in the church. And what I tell people is, put your doctrinal meter on mute, okay? I didn't say turn it off, okay? It's still going to be there. It's still going to go off. And it might even deservedly need to go off. But there's something more important happening than whether that person is right or wrong relationally. And that is, you want to understand or try and understand why they're coming from where they're coming from and what their whys and wherefores are. I call this getting a spiritual GPS reading on someone. Yeah. And so in these conversations, rather than being in rebuttal mode and debate mode and conflict mode, what you need to be is in a listening mode. Pretty good biblical verse for this. Let us be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger, For the anger of man does not accomplish the righteousness of God. By the way, the way the world reads this verse is, let me be quick to hear, or sorry, yeah, let me be slow to hear, quick to speak, and quick to anger, because the anger of man allows me to vent the way I really feel. Okay? That's the alternative to that verse. Yeah. That's the way the world handles it. And so I'm interested in where that other person is coming from and why, because the deeper I go to understand what's motivating them, I'm actually put myself in a better position to have a better conversation with them. And so I don't respond with rebuttal. I respond instead with questions that wants to hear why they think the way that they do. Yeah. And here's the beauty of this. If you treat someone that way, when it's your turn to speak, hopefully they'll do the same thing with you. Yeah. And you've just opened a door.
Yeah. And if y'all were around a few weeks ago, right, Pastor Byron came, and he was just talking about witnessing, right? And this is his whole thing, right? Yeah. He's our minister for local and global missions, right? And the thing that he said over and over was, all I'm doing while I'm witnessing is asking people questions, right? And finding what is the right question to ask, right? Now, he'll share the gospel, but 90% of that conversation is asking questions to do exactly that, right?
Because
to
be able to communicate. What you're looking for when you're asking questions is not only the person's why or wherefore. Mm-hmm. You're trying to see if they surface values or points of view that you can connect to and use as a road or a bridge into a discussion of substance about the gospel.
Yeah.
And so sometimes what you find is the other person shares a value they have. They may apply it differently, but you share the value or the virtue that they are raising, you just apply it in a different way.
Yeah.
That becomes a different kind of discussion when that happens, with all kinds of opportunity associated with it. So that's one of the things that happens in conversation.
Yeah.
And last thing I'll say is this. There are also things that we do in conversations that kill them. Okay? Yeah. And these are modeled before us 24/7 in the public square on television. All you have to do is turn to any news channel of your choice. Doesn't matter whether it's red, blue, purple, green, or chartreuse. All right? They all do it. They all engage in these kinds of things that undercut conversations. One of them is called the pivot. I was taught this by public relations people because I sometimes have to speak in public. The pivot is someone raises something that puts your position in an uncomfortable position. And you are taught either to say yes and then go but and pivot and raise an alternative thing to change the topic, or you're told to ignore the question and pivot immediately to what it is you want to discuss. This is sometimes called whataboutism, okay, where someone will raise something and rather than respond to the problem that that represents coming from the person who's raised it, you raise what you want to raise with them. It's actually, if you think about it at the deepest level, it's disrespectful. It's fundamentally disrespectful to say, you want to talk about this, but I want to talk about that, so we're going to talk about that. So that's one thing that we do. Second thing that we do, and this is in all our political commercials. So we're taught how to do this. And then we're like sheep, okay? We repeat what we see. It's what I call the exorcism. It is debate by label. I label you. It's an equal opportunity employer. Everybody does it. Okay? I label you so I don't have to discuss substance.
Yeah.
Okay? So let me show you how this works, because we all need to learn how to be exorcists.
L. Liberal. C. Conservative. F. Fundamentalist. M. Marxist.
Okay, you see how this is going.
Yeah. Conspiracy theory.
Conspiracy. CT. I can't do it with two. I can do the C, but then I can't do the T. All right? So that's too complicated. That's two words. Okay? All right? That's a long label. So anyway, the point here is you label someone, and the point of the label is to play taps over whatever it is they believe and why. And it's dismissive, And it's also ultimately disrespectful. Even if it's true, it's a little bit disrespectful. Because it doesn't want to get into the detail of the conversation. It's issue avoidance as well as an attempt to bury the other person by label and drape them in black and put them to death so that you can move on. Yeah. Okay? Think how much of our political discourse operates this way in the way we spend millions of dollars to do this to one another. And you ask why our public square is not civil.
Yeah.
You get what you pay for. Those are two examples. There are a few others, but those are the two major ones I'll bring up. They kill good conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I want to open us up to questions. But I had one more, if you're willing. Now I'm
okay.
I've gone totally off the guide
that's
here.
That's fine.
Are there issues in particular that you feel like it's the most difficult for us to do that with? Are there things that come up, you know, these kind of classic controversial conversations that you feel like we struggle the most with?
So that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it. I'm glad, even though it's not on the sheet, I'm glad you asked it. This is really an important question.
Yeah.
There are three kinds of issues in the public square. They come in three forms. The first one is genuine worldview clash. What I mean by that is the starting points are so absolutely disparate that there is very little chance of finding common ground because the starting points are so different from one another. As far as I can tell, and this could be discussed, but I think there are only two issues that fit in that category. Discussion on abortion, because that rotates on the belief of when life begins, and the second one is the discussion on same-sex marriage and things tied to sexuality, because that's rooted in how people see gender and those kinds of issues. So Those are the two that the church has locked in on because they are genuine worldview clash issues. Mm-hmm. Second category is this, what I call same goal, different route. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't avoid controversy. You still have it, but it operates differently. So let me give you the example in this category. The example in this category is racial reconciliation. If I walk out on the street and ask the raw question, should the races be reconciled to one another? In other words, should we have that aspiration? The approval numbers will be so high that most politicians would say, ooh, I'd like that number. Okay, you ask the next question, how do we do this? And now you're having your conversation. All right, but at least you know you're aiming at the same thing, okay? That's different dynamic than worldview clash, all right? The third category is the one where most of our politics lands. It's where most of our public debate on policy lands, and yet we think, not in this category, but we tend to make them all number ones.
Yeah.
So let me tell you what this category is. This category is, we live in a fallen world. Because we live in a fallen world, that means certain things are dysfunctional. They're not aligned or calibrated correctly to one another. As a result of that, okay, what this means is that I've got virtues that can collide as opposed to being aligned. And then this is what happens. Our political parties come along, and one party says, this is the virtue I'm going to lift up, and then the other virtue they either try and minimize or do away with. And the other political party says, no, this is the virtue I'm going to lift up, and they push against the virtue that's embraced by the other side, and everyone digs in. And we make it a raw binary, where if I'm all of this, I can't be any of that, or vice versa. And we never have the discussion that we need. Discussion that we need is, how do we calibrate and relate these virtues to one another so that we have a better result than where we are now?
Yeah.
We never have that conversation. That's where most of our politics lands. And unfortunately, If I take that category three and make it into a category one, what comes with category one is a tendency not to listen. And not to have the calibration discussion we might need. In fact, not even to engage and be aware, there might be something coming off of this other side that I need to pay attention to in the midst of holding what I believe. Yeah. I may not embrace it all, but I may need to embrace some of it. I may need to tweak some of the things that I think about this space because of issues, legitimate issues that are coming at me from the other side. Yeah. And am I open to that?
That's exactly what I see happening all the time, right? There's this, I'm going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? So to speak, yeah. And that's...
And I can't trust you enough to make any effort to listen to what you might be saying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's, yeah, it is a matter of trust, right? Mm-hmm. That's, okay, I want to allow enough time for questions. So does anyone have a question? David, thank you, David. You're our runner for the mic. You're not going to be amplified like I am, but on the podcast, we'll be able to hear you. Okay, so it is working. But does anyone have a question for Dr. Bach? Yeah.
Talking about conversations, how do you label a person that wants to talk and have a conversation with you, but when you turn around and start talking to him about some of the issues that you like to talk, they say, those don't interest me at all, what you're talking about.
So they're one-sided in what they're wanting
to
discuss.
It's hard to have a two-way conversation when some person is not interested in having a two-way conversation. That's the first thing to say. Second thing to say is, and this is why I've said what I've said up to this point, is what you're trying to do in these conversations is to create an environment where that's not the reaction. So what I haven't thought about it this way, but maybe this is a way to think about it. What I'm talking about is an attempt to get ahead and prevent that from being the reaction by the way you react that surprises them.
Yeah.
Okay? You're actually talking about crashing a stereotype in some cases here, where someone, oh, you're a Christian? I know what you believe, and I know what you're going to tell me. And I know how you're going to say it to me, et cetera, et cetera. And when you crack that stereotype and they go, you don't fit what I'm expecting, okay? You don't fit what I'm expecting. You create an environment because you've made the effort to listen to them, okay? Like I say, you hopefully create the environment back that has them doing the same thing with you. Now, they may or may not do it. And if they're not interested, they're not interested. But even in the most difficult discussions, sometimes there's an opportunity to crack that door open. Let me do it with abortion, okay? Because abortion is a difficult and emotional topic because lives of people are at stake. And so in the midst of thinking about the abortion space, someone says to you, well, you know what? This is about my having the right to decide what I do with my own body. Okay, and I go, yeah, in most cases, I think that's a legitimate concern. And then how do you deal with that? Or this scenario. Because this is where I think we really need to think through how we talk about the abortion space in a totality. And it goes like this. A person who is born in the poorest part of town, a 15-year-old, in a broken family, gets pregnant. And says to herself, if I carry this child to term, I have no way of being able to support this child. So I'm going to try and encourage this girl to do the right thing and take the child to term. What does that entail? Yeah. What comes with that recognition? What comes with that recognition is not just the decision about whether she's going to keep the child or not. What comes with that decision is the ability to try and supply and support her so that when she feels very alone and thinks she can't do something, she catches a vision of the possibility that maybe I can do this if I have the help of other people. Now, that is a huge tonal difference in the conversation. And that's the whole area of what we're talking about. So if we're going to talk about being pro-life, okay, let's be pro-life in all caps. Let's be pro-life in such a way that I not only urge the person to make the right decision, but I actually engage in the commitment or have, and there are communities that do this, that make the effort to supply that person with the support that they need in order to make that right decision and feel like it's even a possibility for them. Yeah. Yeah. So even in an area that's a number one, that's a worldview clash, I can still be thinking relationally and conceptually about ways that may challenge the stereotype they have about the view that I hold.
Yeah. And that's what Jesus tells us, right? As far as it is possible for you, live at peace with everyone, right? Now, the person you're talking to probably hasn't read this book, right? Probably hasn't, you know, they're not prioritizing that, living at peace, right? But, and, you know, at some level, maybe they're not going to do that, right? But you can enter the conversation that way, and that's
and you
that's
can encourage, you can try, yeah. All I can do is try and be as persuasive about the value of what I am sharing as I can be. Let me give you one more thought. It's terrible, but let me do it. We're used to telling people that something is true because it's in the Bible. We've been taught that, yeah. Okay? The Bible tells me so. It's true because it's in the Bible. You should do it because it's in the Bible. Now, I've already suggested to you, to the person who's agnostic or atheist, that means next to nothing. But now I want to tell you how the Bible works and why we should pay attention to what I'm getting ready to say next. Something is true not because it's in the Bible. It's in the Bible because it's true. God put it in the Bible because he's talking about the best way to live, the most humane, beneficial way to live. And to be able to explain that to someone without appealing to the Bible is harder work. But it's actually what the nature of the Bible is. As John Stott says, the Bible is a lens through which we see reality. It's a means to an end. But the reality are the concepts that reside in the Bible that are true in and of themselves. So we need to figure out how we make that case to people on those kinds of levels, which is, like I say, is harder work, but it actually is what is required. And in some cases, you can try and make the case, this is the best way for people to live. This is the most beneficial and harmonious way to deal with difference, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When we do that, we actually have the opportunity to build bridges, hopefully with categories some people already have and can grasp. And then you do the best you can. You understand that you're in the world, that the world has its way of seeing things, and you may not persuade them. And then the question is this: what kind of a loser are you? Yeah. What kind of a loser are you? Can you lose well? And sometimes I look around and I go, when the argument is rejected, I'm not sure how good a loser we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, go ahead.
So Megan texted me today to make sure I would be here. She knew I was going to love this topic. So I'm our resident hyper-conservative culture war zealot. I've been sort of...
Here I stand, I can do no other. Go ahead.
I've been sort of building a web of concerns. I mean, we covered a lot of ground, hard to know where to start. But I guess some of the stuff that was said about tone, right, and tone policing, and I think a lot of that made sense in the context of when you're having, like, an individual conversation, and especially makes sense in the context of evangelism and the stuff you said about your example about talking to someone who's considering an abortion. Obviously, yeah, you have to, like, you can't just say, hey, that's wrong. You have to give them that support. But I wonder, does that look any different in the context of, like, a public policy versus individual conversation?
Okay, I'm going to say something that will surprise you. I think it applies even more in public space, because in public space, you are setting examples for how you do these individual conversations.
I guess my concern is because, speaking just on your, you had your categories of issues.
Yeah.
Just focus on the category one issues, right? Because okay. That's what I think of when I think of the culture war. I know sometimes people have different ideas of the culture war. I once recently heard someone say that, actually someone from the pulpit of our church was talking about the culture war and used like taxation as an example. I'm like, that's not the culture war. The culture war is about, right, children that are being, you know, having their parts mutilated and babies that are being murdered. That's what to me the culture war is. And that's the part that we can't yield on at all. And tone policing on those topics feels like it's losing. Like it feels like you played a lot of taps, but it feels more like sounding a retreat. And I don't.
I've spoken out with exactly the same position on abortion that you have.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to back off on the idea that I think this is murder, that people are losing their lives. Okay. But now I've got to ask this question next to someone who doesn't think that's what's going on. How am I even going to begin to get them to think that they could be wrong?
Well,
it's by engaging in this kind of conversation with this kind of an approach, okay? It's by getting to the thing. Remember that I said, and whether talking about evangelism or conversations, we're talking about the idea that people do not have the categories that they need in order to think clearly or to do the right thing or to respond appropriately. When their concern for their liberty or their well-being is the most dominant thing that's going on in their decision-making process, I want to raise other sets of concerns with them other than that. And I want to do it not just with the idea that the child is being murdered, but I also want to do it with the fact of getting them to think about what the impact of that is, what that means for them long term, what that may mean for their health and their ability to have future children. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of other things that I can raise, all designed to do one thing, and that is to put what Greg Kuchel has called a rock in their shoe. Okay, you know what a rock in the shoe is? Okay, it's a pain in the neck. Only it's not a pain in the neck, it's a pain on the foot. All right? So I get a rock in a shoe. What do you do when you get a rock in a shoe? You shake it around, right? If you do what I do, when I get a rock in a shoe, and I'm assuming I'm in a place where I can't just take the shoe off and get it out. I try and move that rock around and get it to a place where hopefully God has given me enough of an arch, okay, that it can kind of sit there for a while until I can get to a point where I can take off my shoe and get the rock out of my shoe. So what you're talking about, you're trying to think about, how do I give this person, given where they are coming from, pause about what it is that they're thinking. Paul even did this in Acts 17. Okay, in Acts 17, he starts off at Mars Hill. We know what he thinks about idolatry. He tells us at the end of Romans 1 what he thinks about idolatry. Okay, and he's not mincing words. Okay, and then in the beginning of the passage, before he gets to Mars Hill in Acts, it says, Paul went around and saw the idols, and his spirit was provoked within him. That's the language of the verse. Let me translate that for you. His blood pressure changed. He saw the idols, and his blood pressure changed. He was, to use a German phrase, nicht froh, which means not happy. Okay, so he was very uncomfortable. And yet, when he gets to Mars Hill, in the opening, after being described as a seed picker, okay, wasn't a compliment. We'd like to welcome the Apostle Paul, the founder of a new religion that you need to hear about here on Mars Hill. That's why we brought him in here. No, he was brought as a curiosity. And how does he begin? He begins by saying, I see that in every way you are very religious. What? Okay, now I grew up in the 60s. Okay, and I grew up in Texas in the 60s. So this causes me to raise a question. Paul, what have you been smoking? Okay, what have you been smoking? Okay, so here's what he's saying. Let me paraphrase it for you. What he's doing is he's saying this. I see you are interested in spiritual things, so let's talk about it. Okay? He's building a bridge. And then he builds a second bridge. Second bridge is, you know what, one of those idols? Called to the unknown God. Okay? So you're admitting that there's something here you would like to figure out. Okay? So let's go there. That's bridge number two. Then he challenges. He puts a rock in their shoe. You think that by building a building that you can contain the God who created all this? Because all this is a little bigger than the building. Okay? That's what he's saying. So then the rock goes in the shoe. So you don't abandon your convictions, but you think long and hard about how you frame it and about how you present it to them. And you try and present it in a way in which the reaction is not to send up phaser shields and say, I'm not going to listen to you, but to send up some type of a bridge that says, that makes me curious. Where are you going with this? Now, granted, okay, let me step back, because I don't want to be unfair. There are certain people, certain conversations, certain ways in which it gets framed, certain ways in which it's presented, where the signals are sent, I am not interested in a conversation at all from the other side.
That's kind of where I was going next.
Like, okay.
There's like a distinction between people with.
Exactly right. But if I debate them in kind, where am I going?
Right. Well, this is why I wonder if tone policing is always appropriate, because there's some people with whom you can't have debate and you just have to stop them from doing what they're doing.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. That's when you recognize a conversation here is not possible. Okay. And I'm still going to stand with my convictions. But here's what happens when I do it the way that I'm talking about. Because I'm in the public square a lot. I'm put in situations in which the person across from me in certain interviews is arguing for their position, and then there's my position. And we are framed in a way that puts us in opposition with one another. When I'm in those situations, I'm not actually as interested in the person I'm debating with as I am the person listening to the two of us, who's going to make a decision. The decision that they're going to make is, which of these two people would I rather listen to? Which of these two people makes the most sense to me? Which of these two people seems the most caring and concerned and aware of what's going on around them? Reasonable, you use that word, absolutely. So in other words, I want to engage in such a way that my God is attractive to approach. Now, let me bring up another issue that comes up, because it often comes from people who are thinking like you are, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Don't misread me, okay? But it's this. I sometimes get, well, wasn't Jesus sometimes pretty harsh? He wasn't always gentle, okay? Yeah? And now I ask a question back. Who was Jesus harshest with? Pharisee. I never get a hesitation on the answer. Now the next question is the hard one. Why? Why was Jesus harder on the Pharisees than virtually anybody else? And why was he so gentle with the people whose lives were in a different place? Not only were they lying, who are they claiming to represent? They were claiming to represent God, and they weren't. Okay, exactly. That's the lie. Okay, the lie is we are reflecting who God is and what he's all about. And Jesus is going, excuse me? Really?
Yeah.
You think God is honored by that? Okay, don't take me there. Okay, because once I get started there, we'll really have a problem. Yeah. Because we are defending things in the church today coming from people who we feel the need to defend for tribal reasons that 10 years ago we never would have defended.
Mm. Yeah.
Say that last again.
We are defending things today. I am hearing church leaders defend things today coming from people who belong to our tribe, or who claim to belong to our tribe, that 10 years ago, if it was coming from someone else of the other tribe, I would have condemned. Mm. And it's the same behavior.
Yeah.
Such as?
Huh?
Such as, I guess I'm...
If you have to guess to figure that out, you have not been paying attention to what's going on in the world.
Mm. No, I mean, no, you're saying the church is defending things it shouldn't be defending?
I'm saying the church is defending things it shouldn't be defending.
Yeah.
In terms of character. In terms of character.
I'm sure if you need an example, I would know what you were talking about and agree.
You should be you shouldn't have to search for an example because it's all around us.
Sure.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's hard, right, to see in retrospect.
You realize what the result of that is?
Hmm.
The result of that is that we're losing a lot of young people to the church because they look at that and they go, that's nothing but hypocrisy.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other? We have a few more minutes. I know. Yeah, Laura. Yeah.
So in the beginning of what you were talking about, you talked a lot about approaching conversations with people from the attitude of remembering what your life was or who you were before Christ found you. And you also mentioned that you came to know Christ in college. So for those of us...
I know where this question's going. Experience. Go ahead. This is great. This is a good question.
But for those of us who don't have any significant life before we knew Christ, like, I'll be honest.
You grew up in a Christian home. You came to the Lord when you were young.
I don't have memory before. I grew up being told I accepted Christ when I was 2. I have no memory, but woo! I know Christ.
Man, she should be on staff.
Please don't.
2. Oh, my goodness.
I don't remember doing it, but no, I know.
We won't talk about your diapers. Go ahead.
But what advice do you... I have an idea of how I would approach that conversation, but it looks different than what you presented.
You're exactly right, okay? Yeah. And that's a great question. You know theologically what the Bible says about your need for God. You know on the other side, because you've experienced what God has supplied to you, what that need is and what that represents. That's what you draw on. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. One more. Yeah. 2 more. No, that's perfect. Oh, here, Alan, 1 second. Let me, there you go. No, you're fine. You're good.
All right, we're talking about how we engage when we're trying to persuade. And you brought up 1 Peter 3:15, talked about he started with hope. And then as we were just talking about, you had to deal with the other person, recognizing that you yourself were perhaps in the same position that they are. And then you, in 3:15, this is my question, it says, present your answer. Excuse me, I touched it and it immediately went somewhere
else.
Yeah,
I've done that before. That's a pain in the
but anyway, it says about the hope that within you, and as you present it with kindness, which I understand, gentleness, yeah, kindness, yep, understanding. And then he says, and fear. And I've
2 Greek words. Okay, there are 2 Greek words. Phobos, here are the 2 Greek words. That's right. Greek word is phobos, the second word. First word is the word pratitas, which is meekness or gentleness, right, something to that effect. Fear is actually the word respect, okay? Okay? It is the word respect. The beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord, okay? It isn't just I'm shaking in my boots because I'm a... No, I respect him, okay? I respond to him. So it's the Greek word phobos, which has this element of respect tied to it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian. This way.
Have you ever considered the times right after Christ, particularly maybe the Eastern Orthodox Church, where you look at Russian or Greek, Serbian, those churches, there was a cultural element specific to that culture ingrained in how the church spread. Mm-hmm. And in light of that, you know, so Europe was pagan. And America is the outgrowth of the bloom of that, of Christ. And now that we might more resemble a cut flower where we've lost the root. Mm. So do you think...
Does that make a difference? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, because you mentioned earlier that we're used to being in a bubble, and that'd be more like, well, you grew up in a time that Christianity was pretty dominant, and I think we may be mirroring more of a time where, like, okay, what if the whole landscape was pagan and we're sacrificing babies?
Okay, so let me take two shots at this because it's a very good question. The first is this, that the reason I like the example of the early church is the church had no social power, no political power, no cultural power. All it had was its spiritual power. Seemed to do pretty well. So that's the first observation to make. Second observation to make is that in one sense our task is harder than it was for the first century. Here's why. Christianity stepped into a cultural vacuum with no history and baggage tied to itself as it made its appeal in the first century. Okay, it was the new boy on the block. There are parts of American history, if you study American revivalism, where in the Northeast, which has some of the highest statistics of being religiously unengaged in our country, currently, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, all have very high percentages of non-church involvement and non-religious engagement. It's called the burnt over district. It's called the burnt over district because the history of the American revivalism movement in two waves in American history, one tied to George Whitefield and the other tied to the Wesleys, okay, came and went, and the Northeast was very impacted by that. They had a deep and direct exposure of Christianity, which they have now rejected. So there is history and a baggage associated with Christianity that exists in that part of the world. That's not the situation of the first century. So the question becomes, how do you reverse an extant stereotype? Okay? In the first century, you had no stereotype for what Christians were. They were new. How do you reverse an extant stereotype? Yeah. You got to crash it.
So I'm not as familiar with what you mentioned in the Northeast. What was actually rejected was wrong?
Well, eventually what happened is there was a walk away from the faith for a variety of reasons. You brought up a third thing that I want to be sure I mentioned, so I'm just putting it back in my head. So what happened was eventually they walked away from the faith. What happened in the fundamentalist modernist controversy were challenges about the Bible and challenges about the ethics of Christianity and its relationship to the core story of Christianity, the core theology of Christianity, that got separated. And now I've got a dilemma because I have two things I want to tell you, so I'm going to continue on the track that I'm on, and I'm going to go back and recover the other thing that I want to say if I remember it. This is actually where we are. We are where we are because in Christianity originally it was seen as holistic, okay? It not only was designed to impact my personal life, it was seen as impacting all of existence. That's why you had state churches. That's why you had the debate about abolition, okay? Because Christianity was seen as the natural expression of what's supposed to go on between people, okay? Touching every area of life. What happened in the fundamentalist modernist controversy is liberals came along and they said, we like the ethics of Christianity and caring for the marginalized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what became the social gospel, but we don't believe the core theological story that's underneath it. And they pulled the two things apart. Okay? Conservatives looked at that attack and reacted, okay, understandably at one level, but they reacted in what became a problematic response, which was, we like the theological story of what's going on over here, and we're going to pay less attention to the ethics that are involved with it over here. And both sides pulled Christianity apart, but for different reasons. We are still in that divide today. Yeah. And then my somewhat humorous, but I'm actually serious line is, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. They belong together. They're connected to one another. They're supposed to be seen together. And to only do half, either half, is a problem. Okay? One might argue one problem is more than another. I won't get into that debate. I think that could well be true. But as long as there is a separation between what I believe doctrinally and how I'm supposed to be called to live biblically, I've got a problem. Yeah. Okay, now here's the other thing that I wanted to say to you. It's this. So here's where we are. We went in my lifetime from being the home team that most people were rooting for to being the visiting team. Only we're not just the visiting team. We're the rivals. We're the rivals who get booed. That change has happened in my lifetime. And we've got to figure out as a church community how you function credibly and believably in that environment when everything in your gut wants to tell you we need to fight back against the world the way the world fights against us. The moment we do that, we lose because we become no different than the world.
That's really good. And I know we have gone. I don't want to take your entire evening. we could be here all night. But these were great questions, y'all. Can we say thank you to Dr. Bach? Thank you for coming all the way out here and sharing with us. This is really helpful and insightful. So thank you for coming out here.
Glad to do it. I've told you before, I think San Antonio is a jewel in the state.
Yes.
And it's underappreciated. And so I always enjoy coming to San Antonio.
Yeah. Hey, well, if you're willing, we might have you back. We can do a part two. But as we do, y'all, can we pray for each other around tables? Because what we don't want to do is leave here just with a lot of ideas and not having done any prayer for one another. So pray for each other around tables, and especially including how can we engage better with the world, right? So pray for each other, and then we will get up on out of here, and there's lots of food to go. So feel free to take a plate. But let's pray for each other, and then we will go from here. Thank you all.